Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. I have had the pleasure of talking to some of the leading authors, artists, activists, and change makers of our time on this podcast. And I want to personally thank you for subscribing, listening, and sharing 100 plus episodes over 100,000 times. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy. And I look forward to more conversations with those important voices that will bring clarity to the situation we find ourselves in as we move toward November of 2024. If you appreciate these conversations and my cultural and political commentary, please subscribe to this podcast, In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, on your favorite platform, and to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. I'd really appreciate the help. Thank you.
I've had a three-part definition I've used for years. As an evangelical, somebody who takes the Bible seriously, believes in the centrality of a conversion or born-again experience, and who seeks to evangelize or to bring others into the community. And I'm not sure that fits any longer. I don't know what it is. I mean, this is the, you know, and I know you share these sentiments, but this is the faith of my childhood. This is the faith that formed me and shaped me and helped me understand the world, helped me understand the distinction between right and wrong. And now it is utterly abandoned any semblance of morality or, you know, what is right and what is wrong. It's so distressing to me.
Hey, so Randall, what you been doing since we talked last, which was like 2 minutes ago? We had lunch or something, and then we've done, I forget if we did our podcast since then, or we just...
I don't know if we have either. Did we do? Yeah, I think we did. We did one on bad faith. The book that you, I think you endorsed that book, didn't you?
I did, yes, indeed. Did. And I remembered the other day, I was thinking about how long ago it seems that we were on stage together at Wild Goose Festival.
Right. That's right. It's been a while.
And, you know, we keep meeting in the oddest places.
That's right.
And actually, are you well and happy? Are things good?
Things are good. Actually, I'm on a kind of mini sabbatical. So I'm out in Colorado until June. So I'm having a good time. I'm trying to finish my biography of Mark Hatfield. Do you remember him?
Yeah, I know. I knew Mark. He was this Roman Catholic congressman or senator from, where was he from? Oregon? No, not Oregon.
Oregon. Yeah. No, he wasn't Roman Catholic. He was Baptist. His wife was Catholic. But
yeah, but he was sort of a pacifist anti-war guy, but he was pro-life. I remember.
Yep. You know, he actually, in my research, I have concluded he is the first evangelical to come out against Roe v. Wade. Just a couple of months after the decision, he was the first. He was the first.
Yeah because I remember we talked after our film series came out, and it was like he you know, agreed with the position that we had, and talking all about that. So,
yep.
Anyway, yeah, Mark Hatfield was an interesting guy. So what led you to write why did you get into writing a book on Mark?
Well, he was kind of a hero of mine going back to my college days. And so, and I got to know him a little bit toward the end of his career. Mm. And he was just so kind and so gracious, as I'm sure he was with you too. He was just an extraordinary man. And the fact that he was one of the first, he was not only one of the first to be against Roe v. Wade, he was one of the first to be against the war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, and that wonderful tension, which we would not see embodied in almost any politician today. You know, those two positions, I think is fascinating to me.
Yeah. So, he was a sort of a consistent pacifist.
He was.
And somebody who would not be able to get elected these days.
No, that's right.
To either party. Hey, let me introduce you properly. This is In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, a podcast and live Facebook event. And my guest today is a friend, Professor Randall Balmer. And Randall is John Phillips Professor in Religion at Dartmouth College and the author of many books, including Bad Faith, Race and the Rise of the Religious Right, and most recently, Passion Plays, How Religion Shaped Sports in North America. Please subscribe to this podcast and In Conversation with Frank Schaefer on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe to my Substack commentary, It Has to Be Said, at frankschaefer.substack.com. So, Randall, I really, you know, we have so much to talk about because so much is happening. But before we get there, I want to dive into your book for a minute here that I read this morning and really enjoyed. And I want to go to a couple of quotes just to talk about here. You said one thing that I found very interesting. This is early in the book. Each sport, therefore, reflected or reacted against the zeitgeist. Baseball and the Industrial Revolution, football and the Civil War, hockey and the formation of the Canadian Confederation, basketball and urbanization. Each sport, in turn, developed certain characteristics, meanings that helped to explain its appeal in different eras, in different regions, and to different geographic groups. And then I wanted to ask you, you know, what does the rise of soccer recently reflect? Do you think that sort of reflects our woke moment? You know, and I'm sort of half kidding, but also kind of serious here. How do you see that? Because it's very much coming on with Messi here and all the rest of it. It's going to become an American sport and not just kind of a European transplant. And it happens at this moment. And I thought your whole analysis of how sports play into American life and religion and all that, we're going to get into that. But also, I just found it very interesting that you kind of tagged each sport as a revelation of an American moment of history. I loved that. I thought it was very original. By the way, I've never, ever read anything like that from somebody else. I think that's totally your thing. So what about soccer? Where does that come in?
You know, I'm going to beg off on that question, Frank, because I don't know much about soccer, I have to say. And it didn't seem to fit into what I was trying to do, I guess, more as a historian. You're right. Soccer is now coming into the American consciousness in a big way. But the other sports I was looking at really had their gestation period roughly from the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century. And so soccer, I think, probably didn't quite fit that. If I had to make a kind of on-the-fly sort of analysis, soccer strikes me as what some sports historians describe as a mob game. And I don't mean that critically, but it's where, you know, you have this kind of convergence of players, particularly in the more amateur soccer matches, you know, where the kids all gravitate to the ball, right, that sort of thing. And I think what happened with these other major sports is that they started as mob games, mm-hmm. but they over time developed rules, developed boundaries. I mean, as you know, I make a big deal in the book about the importance of boundaries.
Sure.
As being a defining moment in the evolution of sports. And I think soccer in many ways still hasn't quite done that. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it will. I think it's just a different game, a different sort of enterprise.
You know, at one point you say, you talk about muscular Christianity, and I'll let you define that in a minute. But then you say, then serve both religious and sociological ends. And then you add to that, after examining the beginnings, evolution, and symbolism of each sport, I will suggest that the increased passion for sports in recent decades has, for many, displaced traditional expressions of religion. And I'm going there because it happens that I recently have read an essay that I'm sure you saw the same information wherever it's been, because it would be on your radar screen, just talking about the evolution of evangelical Christianity away from its roots to the point where a lot of people are wearing the evangelical brand as a political signifier, like their MAGA brand.
Yes.
But they're not going to church. They're not part of a church community to the point where it's more of a political branding name for the unchurched than it is a reflection of evangelical Christians of the kind that raised me, that was all about church and prayer meetings and community. And I think that's a segue into your field big time. And I would really like you to riff on that, because I think that's a huge subject as we head into 2024 toward the election. You know, we talk about the evangelicals this, the evangelicals that. My friend Tim Alberta has written this book, The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory. I interviewed him a few days ago, and his book is an argument, an interesting muscular argument for evangelical Christian faith, as opposed to this sort of denigrated version he describes, even including pastors getting fired because they preached a sermon against Trumpism or whatever it may be. But I think the bigger subject is that your book actually touches on in an odd way, the transformation of evangelical Christianity, the phrase muscular Christianity, and how that translates into our era now. and what has become of evangelicalism. And so if you could unpack that for us, I don't think anybody's more qualified. I'd really forget this is a podcast. I actually want to hear this from you because I've been wondering about it.
Yeah, you're right. I read the same article. It was in the New York Times about particularly evangelicals in Iowa, which is, you know, I consider my home state because I spent my high school years there. And it's true. But you've seen it too, Frank, the wholesale abandonment of anything that you and I would recognize from our childhood as being Orthodox Christianity or Orthodox evangelicalism. I mean, it's just, and it has to do with what you have called correctly the Trump cult, I think, and the extent to which he's just taken things over. Actually, after reading that article, it really kind of drove me to revise my definition of evangelical. And I've had a three-part definition I've used for years. An evangelical is somebody who takes the Bible seriously, believes in the centrality of a conversion or born-again experience, and who seeks to evangelize or to bring others into the community. And you know, I'm not sure that fits any longer. I don't know what it is. I mean, this is the, you know, and I know you share these sentiments, but this is the faith of my childhood. This is the faith that formed me and shaped me, and helped me understand the world, helped me understand the distinction between right and wrong, and now it is utterly abandoned any semblance of morality or what is right and what is wrong is so distressing to me. And I think, you know, to get back to the parallel with sports, yes, I think what we've seen in the culture in the last several decades is a movement away from Orthodox religion or religion generally, and particularly Orthodox Christianity. And where the real passion lies these days, I think, is with organized sports.
Sure.
And that I would take as an indictment of religion. And I think and our religious leaders have failed us. Certainly evangelical leaders have failed us.
Well, you point out in the book, I forget where, I've got the quote someplace, but that, you know, something to the effect that, you know, sports was always a kind of a male thing and the women did the religion.
Right.
You know, I don't know. And we seem to have been, you know, gone even further in that direction now where, you know, the men are, you know, I don't want to be facetious here, but they're doing open carry at some rally in Texas carrying a semi-automatic weapon. And, you know, there's still some women somewhere at a prayer meeting, but the men have moved on. They're just totally into the MAGA white Christian nationalist thing now, much more than I would have imagined possible 40 years ago when we were in the movement.
I think that's right. And that circles back to the term you mentioned earlier, muscular Christianity. I mean, that was the impetus for muscular Christianity back in the 19th century, is that these churchmen, particularly in England, were looking out into their congregations and seeing overwhelming numbers of women more than men. And so they devised this whole notion of that came to be called muscular Christianity, where you would try to associate the Christian faith with athletic endeavors and militarism, both athleticism and militarism. And as you know, that comes right from the New Testament, from Paul.
Yeah.
Paul talks about putting on the full armor of God, finishing the race, you know, running the course and so forth. So those are our New Testament metaphors. And that spawned this movement that also fed organizations like Salvation Army, militarism, and in particular the YMCA, which is, of course, associated with athleticism.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, again, I'm not trying to be facetious, but I wonder if there's a connection between the fact that far more women are now going to and graduating from college and university than men are, and this connection to sports and muscular Christianity. I mean, you know, Paul had a solution, and that is basically he said, hey, just because I believe in Jesus, I'm not a wimp. I'm going to talk in militaristic terms to bring guys in. And by the way, the women should be silent anyway. So I'm giving you guys, I'm putting you all in charge as the male here in the room.
And how did that work out?
How did that work out? Not so well. The women ran the churches anyway, and now they're the only people going to college. So this doesn't bode well for us.
No, it doesn't. I'm
I
afraid it
mean,
does.
you know, as a 71-year-old white male, it's like, okay, I know where I stand on all this. You know, getting back to the transformation of evangelicalism into this thing yet to be named, the player yet to be named. I was on a podcast today, not interviewing, but being interviewed, and someone said, you know, what happened? And I said, listen, you know, the only thing I can tell you, and as it sounds glib, but because I was a fly on the wall during a lot of this transformation, is that the addiction to power is really, don't underestimate that. You know, and I think that's what happened to us and as a family, my dad and me, as we went there until I bailed and kind of renounced that. But if someone asked me, you know, how did these good people go from here to here? I think a big taste of power, of access to power, of being in that Oval Office advising the president goes a long way. Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. If you appreciate my cultural and political commentary, please do me a favor and subscribe to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. You can subscribe for free, or you can kick in a couple of dollars a month and help me out and help me keep this going if you're able. Either way, I'm incredibly grateful for your support and most of all for your participation. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy as we move toward November of 2024. And every subscription helps create, build, sustain, and put voice to this movement for truth. Thank you so much.
I think it does. And the other thing that, again, you know this as well as I, when we're talking about evangelicalism, we're talking about a religious movement that in some ways does not have boundaries. We were talking about boundaries earlier. That is to say, evangelical congregations, as you know, are not bound by creeds. They're not bound by tradition. They're not bound by liturgy. There is no hierarchy. And so what tends to happen, particularly in the megachurches, is that you have congregations that coalesce around a cult of personality. And that personality, very often, and we can tick off examples, Gordon MacDonald, Bill Hybels, Mark Driscoll, you can go down the line. That personality has very little accountability. And that's where the power comes in, as you talked about. And it's bracing, I'm sure. I've never really tasted it myself, but it's bracing and addictive. And it never ends. It always ends badly, it seems to me.
I'm talking with Randall Balmer today. This is In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, which you are watching live on Facebook and or listening to as a podcast. I just want to jump back to your book here for a second because there were some wonderful quotes that I kept pulling out that I wanted to talk with you about. One is the United States has long been one of the most religious nations in the world, with 89% of the population affirming their belief in God, according to the Pew Research Center in 2014. Canadians lag a bit, but they are not far behind. 76% claimed a religious affiliation in a 2011 survey. As impressive as those numbers are, especially as compared with France, Japan, or Great Britain, the percentage of the population that would be considered devout has fallen in recent years. So that's what we were talking about. And I want to go back to that for a minute because, you know, there's been so much going on in our news and our politics and worldwide and wars and the rise of theocratic movements globally and so on that I think, you know, let's talk a little bit about just the decline of the influence of what I would call authentic religion in America as opposed to its political manifestation of militant Protestant, evangelical, fundamentalist, you know, who don't go to church anymore but are all about Trump. Talk to, you know, you are ordained and you are a professor and you're an author. And I think of anybody I could be talking about in North America right now, who could actually give some real light on this. I mean, what has happened? Are we just becoming Europe, as in we're now more secularized, as the French did with Catholicism? Is it about American politics? Did Trump do this to us and finish us off? Was he the coup de grace on something that would have devolved anyway into, you know, Generation Z, you know, they don't go to church, but they do do witchcraft and tarot cards and spirituality and things. So it's not even, I mean, these are not Enlightenment secularists either. This is not, these are not followers of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the Enlightenment. How did this happen to us? What's going on? What's going on with the religion in America, aside from all the politics? What's happened?
It's a really good question. And I think the examples you cited about Tarot and spiritualism and witchcraft or paganism, whatever it is, speaks to this continuing hunger for some sort of transcendent, some sort of metaphysical understanding or approach to the world. I have to think it's the fault of religion. I have a confession to make, Frank. I thought we were going to talk about this book, Saving Faith, rather than the sports book, but that's fine. And one of the quotes I have at the beginning is from Abraham Joshua Heschel, and he says, "It's customary to blame secularism for the eclipse of religion in modern society, but it would be more honest to blame religion for its own defeats. Religion declined not because it was refuted, but because it became irrelevant, dull, oppressive, and insipid. When faith becomes an heirloom rather than a living fountain, when religion speaks only in the name of authority rather than with the voice of compassion, its message becomes meaningless." I think that's pretty good. But I think when we're talking about evangelicalism, and again, both of us were reared within this world, and we know it very well. I think it has devolved in many of these places, particularly megachurches, into entertainment. You know, these days I go to a mega church from time to time, you know, out of sort of professional obligation. And I leave and I think, what was church about that? You know, we had these, you know, kind of, you know, these gauzy praise music singers, and, you know, who are always having, you know, they're holding up the ceiling with their hands and in some sort of dissociated state. You collect an offering, you sing a couple of songs, and then you hear a lecture. Usually it's not really much of a sermon anymore. And then you go home. And, you know, for me, and I think for you, being Orthodox, there's something more. I think that for me, it's the sacraments, the real presence of Jesus in the sacrament is for me what holds it all together. And I've suffered through many bad sermons in the course of my life, and I know you have too. But to have that sense of the presence of Jesus in a tactile form is for me very important. And evangelicals don't have that. They have a memorialist view of Holy Communion that says, you know, we remember Jesus. And I find that a pretty barren theology, frankly.
Well, and not just the sacraments per se in terms of the official sacraments, but the whole sacramental life, a church calendar, understanding the dynamic of how, you know, Western civilization, as it were, rose out of this practice, and that whether you love it or hate it, you know, there's a history here that is bigger than personal experience. You're tapping into a community of belief that goes back a long way. Let me get to Saving Faith here. And first of all, do you have a copy there?
I do, yes.
Well, hold it up and let me look at the cover, because I've got mine online. And so forth and so on. Saving Faith. And then what's the subtitle there? Because I'm
not reading. How American Christianity Can Reclaim Its Prophetic Voice.
Yeah. And that's the short book that you and I exchanged emails about the other day, saying, well, I've got this new book, but it's very short. And how many pages is it? Because I have
it's probably maybe 100. I don't know.
Yeah. So basically it's
over 100.
And when did you write that?
Last year, I wrote it pretty quickly because it was, you know, it was in my head.
When you get into the question of saving faith, just outline, first of all, do you think it can be? Secondly, is it worth it? And third, whose faith are you talking about? And how do you unfold this in the book?
Well, I talk about the fact, and again, we've talked about this earlier in the conversation, Christianity is in trouble right now, particularly in America. Yeah. I think there's no question about that. Mainline Protestantism is, has been on the ropes since the mid-1960s. The Catholic Church is dealing with the whole pedophilia thing, and you've got these conservative bishops who think that Trump is somehow morally superior to Joe Biden. And you have evangelicals who have have sold their soul and their birthright to Donald Trump. And so I begin there and talk about the challenges facing all three of those branches of Christianity, which I think are probably the major three in American life, and how we got there. I think a big part of it is what I call sentimentalism, nostalgia for the 1950s, for example, and the television shows Ozzie and Harriet and Andy Mayberry and all that sort of thing, celebrating this past that really wasn't shared by all Americans by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly, people of color did not share in the post-war prosperity. Sentimentality, I think, is a dangerous lure, I think, in many ways. So we talked about that. I talked about the whole cult of Christian nationalism, or so-called Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure there's much Christian about it. This fallacy, this wishful thinking, I guess, that America was and always has been a Christian nation, which is just demonstrably false and I think very dangerous. And then I tried to talk about how we get out of that, how we try to reclaim our faith. And I think what I try to argue is that somehow we have to reclaim our prophetic voice. And that means not succumbing to the herd mentality, particularly in the direction of Donald Trump, who I think is really a dangerous man. I think you probably share that sentiment. But also recognizing that being on the margins is not such a bad thing. That is to say that, in my sense as a historian of religion in America, is that the most successful prophetic religious voices have always spoken from the margins of society and not in the councils of power. And once you begin to, and you can talk about this with your own life if you wish, but once you begin to hanker after that sort of power and inside influence, you begin to lose your prophetic voice. And I think that's what's happened.
Yeah, and obviously because, the kind of prophetic power, such as it is from the margins, does not depend upon acclaim.
Right.
And the minute you're looking to see how does this play, that's not a prophetic voice anymore.
Exactly.
And then, of course, and there's no way not to look how does this play when you are invited inside the White House and you're having a prayer meeting with the president and he's looking to you as a quote unquote spiritual guide or something like that, or what's happened. How in saving faith, how would you feel the odds are in terms of restoring that prophetic voice from the margins now in the U.S.? Question one. Part two of that question is, how have the Trump years derailed that prospect or further distance us from any type of, what back in the old days would have been called some sort of revival?
Yeah. The first part of your question, I feel as though I have a mandate to be hopeful. I don't think despair is an option. And I think that's true for anyone who is a parent. If you have children, you have to be optimistic. You can't throw up your arms in despair. And I have to say that I fight despair a lot when I look on the national scene. I think there's reason to be worried. There's reason to be concerned about the future. So I try to fight that feeling of hopelessness. I don't think there's any question that the prophetic voices have been marginalized, if not silenced, by the stampede to Donald Trump, particularly within the evangelical world. There's no question about that. Yet, I think there are voices of hope. I would consider you one of those voices, Frank. I think you are, because you're a critic and you're trying to point us in a different direction. Younger people like Shane Claiborne, Tony Campolo is still a hero of mine, Jim Wallace. There are people like that who are trying to make a difference. And I think their voices are out there. The problem is they don't have the kind of media empire that people like James Dobson had, or Pat Robertson, or or Jim Baker at one time, they don't have that sort of megaphone that is characteristic of some of these other religious leaders these days. And that, I think, is a shame.
But if you want to go to the margins, then, you know, at a certain point, that's where you are. You're on the margins, as you were talking about. Let me just go back and say I am talking with Professor Randall Balmer, and we are transitioning to talk about this book, Saving Faith. And I want to also go back to your sports book because I like so much of that. But, you know, you're talking about the fact that many people blame faith for the rampant secularization of society in recent decades, while critics contend that Christians themselves, or at least their leaders, are blind to their own shortcomings. Some, and this is what we're talking about now, of the proposed remedies to appeal to nostalgia, which you were talking about, an attempt to undermine the separation of church and state, trying to throttle religious diversity, and asserting the supposed, quote, Christian origins of the nation, are historically misguided and would only deepen the crisis facing Christianity. So what I wanted to jump to is that if you had had that on the back of your book as a blurb 20 years ago, people would have just said, well, this has nothing to do with where we are now. You know, we're moving away from this, and these are not really relevant discussions. How crazy is it that your book, Saving Faith, inadvertently is torn from the headlines and is front page news in America right now? And every other day I read the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Guardian, whatever, there's an article that is something to do with what you're talking about of, hey, what happened to these, quote, these Christians? Where are they going? What do they represent? Are they really evangelical? You know, are they even Christian anymore? Why is this part of the gun cult? Why is this part of Christian nationalism? How does this fit in with Viktor Orban of Hungary? Why is Vladimir Putin on their side? Why does Tucker Carlson, you know, do all this? I just think it's crazy that you're teaching history and you do religion and you're this expert up there. And then all of a sudden, you know, Randall Balmer is front page news with talk about what happened to Christianity.
Yeah. Well, I'm not
what
sure.
What happened to the secularization of our culture that was all going to be reason and you know, documentaries on evolution all the way down. And all of a sudden it's religion nonstop 24/7 and we're in an election year.
Yeah. And what kind of religion is it? What's the quality of religion? I guess that's the thing that interests me is what is the quality of religion we're talking about? What is the quality of faith we're talking about? And I have to say that I don't find many corners where there's much I find encouraging. You come back to this evangelical pursuit of the cult of Donald Trump. I mean, I guess I'm going to ask you a question. Are you as confounded by this as I am? It defies all reason to me.
Yeah.
How this happened. Now, having said that, I just wrote a lecture that I'm going to be giving in South Carolina in a couple of months, trying to explain it. And I came up with five turning points. I'll see if I can remember them quickly. That I think kind of pointed in this direction. First was the Immigration Act of 1965. Which removed the quotas from the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924 and opened the country to immigrants, particularly from Asia and South Asia. And I know you've seen this as well, but in my lifetime, I've seen Buddhist stupas and Shinto shrines and Hindu temples crop up in the most unlikely places. I never would have imagined this. Mm. It's part of the diversity. And I think a lot of white Christians, particularly evangelicals, said, this is a threat. This is somehow something we're not comfortable with. The second turning point, I think, is a court decision I've written about quite a bit, as you know, the Green v. Connolly decision of 1971 that was the genesis for the religious right because it challenged the tax-exempt status of segregated evangelical schools.
And you talk about how Paul Weyrich and other people jumped on that.
Exactly.
It made it a thing.
I think the third important moment was the fundamentalist takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1979, because the Southern Baptist Convention had been kind of the watchman on the wall of the wall of separation between church and state, and then they abandon that entirely. And so we have, you know, well, everybody's chipping away at that wall, including the Supreme Court these days. I think the fourth was Ronald Reagan's rescission of the fairness doctrine in broadcasting, so that you have all these nutcases out there, you know, spouting conspiracy nonsense and things like that. And in the past, they would have had to have offered equal time to someone to refute that sort of thing. And now we don't have that at all. And I think the final thing was 1981, the federal agents invaded or raided a small town in northern Idaho called Wallace, Idaho. And that led in turn to the Ruby Ridge thing and then finally to the Branch Davidian thing in Waco. And that persuaded a lot of white evangelicals that the government was being, was overreaching and was intruding on their lives and freedom and that sort of thing. Now, I think it's all overblown. But that was, I think those are the, those are some of the steps that led us to this moment, particularly with this movement called Christian nationalism.
Do you think that those steps parallel the kind of general secularization in another time and place of European versions of Christianity? Is that just a trend? I mean, is this the age of science and the bill comes due one way or another, and in America it has this odd twist of the politicizing of religion to the point where it's no longer religion, but a kind of a nationalism? I mean, well, how do you see this? Or is America kind of unique and different than other places?
My sense, again, you lived in Europe, Frank, and I never have, so you probably have a different perspective on this. My sense with Europe is that World War II was really devastating. I mean, not merely in terms of destruction and casualties, but in the sense of destroying any sort of faith in something transcendent. I mean, how, you know, I mean, Elie Wiesel's novel Night, I mean, is a beautiful example of that. You know, how can you believe in God after Auschwitz? Now, I'm not speaking that for myself, because I do still believe in God, but I think for people who went through and saw close up the horrors of Hitler and the Holocaust, I think that probably accelerated the move towards secularism and secularization. And we in the United States haven't had quite that same moment, I don't think.
In Saving Faith, do you predict anything? Or do you just say, here's what's going into this, here's what happened, here's what to do about it? if you had to give, aside from your talk you're about to give in those 5 points, if you had to preach a little sermon on how one saves one's faith, forget the nation, how does that individual action, redemptive action, if you want to put it that way, translate into a national movement that actually changes the face of the United States, not politically, but spiritually?
I think
a huge question, but I'd ask you to go there, because again, I don't know anybody who's wrestling with these questions more than you have. This is, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. What do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, for me as a Christian, it means reaffiliating with the words of Jesus in the New Testament. And if you take seriously the words of Jesus, frankly, I don't see how you can cast a ballot for Donald Trump. I mean, I just don't understand that.
Yeah.
And again, for me as an evangelical, I look at the history of my own tradition, and I see that in the 19th century, in particular, even into the early 20th century, evangelicals were very much concerned about those on the margins of society. And I want to reclaim that. I want to hold that up and try to get people to reaffiliate with those ideas. Now, in many ways, I've spent the last 10, 20 years of my life trying to do that, trying to point people in that direction. And you, Frank, can see how successful I've been in doing that.
Hey, can't have been that successful because you're talking to me.
Well,
I mean, you're calling for, I mean, you've done one thing right. You're calling for us to be on the margins, and you're on my podcast. So, you know,
we're both marginal.
Hey, you know, one of the things that you talk about in Saving Faith and this whole idea of moral authority, and you know, this idea that somehow the major traditions, Catholicism, evangelicalism, etc., have had a crisis of credibility, you go into that. But I want to get back to this thing I asked you a moment ago, and that is, in the best of all worlds, if you, what would the anatomy be of a personal transformation of people who have slidden away from the faith in some way, not necessarily into the Trump cult, but just the general population of America who is no longer, to use the old-fashioned term, churched,
right,
and has really divorced themselves completely from this and seek spirituality, especially younger people? A, do you see a path back? And if you do, hypothetically speaking, on an individual basis, what may that path be? Is there something new that's happening that is different than previous generations because of the internet and the cell phones and this whole kind of dependency on this weird, you know, algorithmic connection to each other through all these crazy sites? Or are we just back on the same old thing of, you know, a cycle of faith and more, lack of faith and reformation revival? Or are we really in a new place now? Is this a brave new world and there's no coming back?
Yeah, it won't surprise you as a historian that I want to point to the past, because I think the past does provide some sort of guidance for us. And I think even if you kind of bracket out issues of religion and faith, I think we as Americans over more than two centuries have developed certain habits and certain ways of being that we have in recent years we've lost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think democracy has its own traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those traditions is the importance of dialogue and conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I see as a threat to that these days is, first of all, the media landscape that I mentioned earlier with the end of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987. But the other is that, particularly with these voices calling for Christian nationalism, it's not that they want merely to express their views in the arena of public discourse, which they are utterly entitled to do, in my judgment.
Mm.
But it's the fact that they want to bracket out every other view.
Mm.
They don't want to listen. They want to speak. They want to yell. They want to shout. They want to sloganeer. But they don't want to listen to any other voices. And I think somehow we have to reclaim those protocols of democracy within our society. And I think I think everybody, anyone who's serious about that, whether those folks are religious or not, need to try to do that.
Yeah,
and it means for me too.
Yeah.
I don't have much patience for Trumpists, I confess, but I've resolved to try to hear them out and try to figure out what's going on there, even though it confounds me in many ways.
Well, a question I want to transition to here, and we're talking about your book, Saving Faith, and everything that comes from that. And weirdly, that does, by the way, tie in well to your book on sports and this American cultural expression of, you know, the Christianity and so forth. You know, you've really only written one book. You're just doing it in long chapters and segments. But, you know, you have a certain discussion going. But I have a question for you related to that, and that is, it seems to me one thing that's different from when I was very involved in this movement is the predilection of a huge chunk of people who call themselves Christians to fall for various conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And I want to, this is a real question. It's not a loaded question. I don't have an answer for it, but I think you might. Aside from Trump, you know, there was a day when evangelicals may believe that Jesus rose from the dead, literally, that miracles happened, that Genesis teaches us something about creation, even if it's something to do with evolution. But nevertheless, they had these, from the point of view of enlightenment reason, unreasonable, unscientific, baseless beliefs. And yet, in the world in which they operated as voters, businessmen, women, doctors, nurses, teachers, mothers, parents, they had a fidelity to a baseline of reason and facticity where they basically subscribed to what you would call, for lack of a better term, everyday common sense on many things. So you could have someone who fervently believes on Easter they're celebrating the physical resurrection of a dead body. And from the point of view of their, you know, atheist friend, you know, who teaches physics at university, they're sort of crazy. But they both vote for the same candidate based on how the economy is doing, based on foreign policy, based on, you know, personality. There's a baseline of fact there. Where did that stop? And why? And how come evangelical Christians, Roman Catholics, and others who could have these crazy supernaturalist beliefs from the point of view of a secular humanist say, you know, what happened to these guys? Suddenly, you know, they went batshit crazy. They left the reservation. They're gone. They're on a whole other planet now, whether it's anti-vax, the whole anti-vaccine movement, whether it's believing that Donald Trump is still somehow president and the election was stolen. You know, there are so many things that you can talk about, you know, that somehow the multiplicity of semi-automatic weapons and high-capacity magazines don't have anything to do with violence. And, you know, when it comes to a school shooting, you know, they have left the planet. So two questions. Why, for centuries of American history, did you have a believing population that from the point of view of science believed in batshit, crazy, unreality, but yet they were common sense, ordinary, you know, sensible, yeah, dependable members of the political and economic community? And now that's broken.
Yeah.
And it isn't just we believe in the resurrection of Jesus. We believe, you know, that some pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. was the nexus of a pedophile conspiracy run by Hillary Clinton or something.
Right,
and no appeal to facts changes this. Why did this happen and where did it happen? And is that part of saving faith to somehow say, wait a minute. You know, believing that Jesus rose from the dead may not be arguable in a biology class, but that has nothing to do with accepting Donald Trump as your personal savior and believing the election was stolen, right, and that there's a big pharma conspiracy to
right,
do something to everybody because these vaccines are actually coming from Jewish space lasers. I mean, whatever.
It's bizarre. Yeah, it's
what the hell happened?
I'll add one more example to your list there. And when Sarah Huckabee Sanders was running, albeit successfully, as governor of Arkansas, one of her platform points was protect our God-given Second Amendment rights.
Right.
So I guess I missed that in Genesis.
Yeah.
Frank, I don't know where that came from. I think you raised a good point. It's a great question. I think part of the appeal of Donald Trump and this, you know, the wackiness that you're talking about has to do with the sense of victimization. These folks feel as though they're victimized in some way. They're marginalized, even though they, as we both know, carry outsized political influence in American society. They nevertheless nurture this idea that we are marginalized, we are victimized. Now, I remember from my evangelical childhood, I felt very much marginalized in from the larger society. So I understand that. But somehow, these various demagogue politicians have been able to capitalize on that. And I think one of the reasons for the popularity of Donald Trump is that he speaks the language of victimization, frankly, better than anyone I've ever seen in my lifetime. Now, it's always about him. He's always the victim. Let's understand that. But I think there was something with evangelicals who, and they recognized that. They said, this guy is speaking our language in some way, even though he you know, he couldn't care a whit about them or what they're worried about. But he was able to exploit that in some way, in part because he was so fluent. He is so fluent at this rhetoric of victimization. I'm not sure that explains it entirely, but I think it's part of it.
It's helpful, and I think that my producer, Ernie Gregg, just sent me a little note here, which I think is a really good question and a way to segue into it, and that is he writes, speaking of the need to address America's, quote, original sin of racism, the leading Republican candidate is now openly quoting the most violent racist speeches of Adolf Hitler. many of whose supporters would probably tell you they are evangelical Christians. How do we square this? And I would just add a footnote to that from what you were just saying about victimization. You know, Ernie has dropped the big H name into our discussion here, but it's unavoidable. But of course, Hitler was a little different than Trump in one way. And that is, of course, he painted his country as the victim of France in the Versailles Treaty and Britain and these others, whereas Trump has now personalized this, and it isn't about his country, it's about him. So we're now one step lower, and that is we're having Hitler speeches to bolster the only real victim in this game, according to Trump, and that's him, the persecuted, you know, con artist who basically attacks anybody who says, hey, you're lying or whatever it may be. And in consequence, they all get death threats, you know, including clerks working for some judge. But the victimization thing I was raised on was that, you know, there are these secular humanists out there. They're trying to get us. Don't believe them. Believe what the Bible says instead. Do you think that set a mindset to go along with someone who then took it to the next state, not only on victimization, but again, back on this idea that everything that is not part of our thinking and theology is fake news? So whatever your biology's teacher is telling you at school, here's what you need to believe because this is what the Bible says, is that, you know, he sort of jumped in that and again personalized it. Whereas, you know, his voice is the Bible. And if they contradict it, then basically believe me and not them.
Right.
And damn the facts.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think you're right. And I think the other thing that makes evangelicalism vulnerable to this, perhaps, and I'm kind of thinking about this as I say it. You know, as you know, what happens in the Protestant Reformation is that one of the bases for authority, that is the church, is wiped away. You know, Martin Luther's sola scriptura, the Bible alone is our source of authority. Well, you and I both know the Bible admits of many, many different interpretations.
Yes.
And depending on which parts of the Bible you read, you're going to have different things. I wrote a piece recently about the new speaker, Mike Johnson. You know, he's fixated on Leviticus. Well, why doesn't he go to Matthew 25 and try to get some policy clues from Matthew 25? Well, he doesn't want to do that because he doesn't like what it says. So that's the issue. And one of the points I try to make in Saving Faith is when people talk about the Word of God, Protestants typically mean the Bible.
Yeah.
But if you take John 1 seriously, the Word of God is Jesus. Right? Mm. In the beginning was the Word. Word was with God, and the Word was God. Right? And if we start to take that seriously and model our lives after Jesus and what he showed us, what he taught us, I think we'd be well on our way, both as Christians, as believers, but as a nation, toward a better world. It's not easy to do, as we know, living according to the words and the teachings and the example of Jesus. But I think that's where we as Christian believers have to start. Jesus is the Word of God.
I'm talking with Randall Balmer. His book is Saving Faith. I've also been talking to him about another book that I really enjoyed, where he's talking about the analogy between sports and culture and society. But I want to go with what you just brought up about Mike Johnson, because it's I interviewed James Carville the other day about his views on Mike Johnson. And what we were both talking about together, and I'd like to get your take on this as a historian and someone who knows about all this, it seemed to me that in Mike Johnson, and his appeal in essence to sort of return to a theocracy rather than a democracy, in that he regards America as a Christian nation. So it's in its truest form, it does not adhere to a constitution, which has humanist overtones from the Enlightenment and so forth, but rather an Old Testament biblical style theocracy. Obviously, I am very attuned to that because, you know, we were part of a movement called the Reconstructionist Movement, or the Theonomists, figures like Gary North, who was the son-in-law of Russ S. Rushdoony, and others, who openly called for a theocracy and actually didn't like American democracy. They were openly antagonistic to the Constitution, which they regarded as a secular document that had bastardized the true origin of America as a city set on a hill, John Winthrop and the others. You know all about this. Let's talk a little bit about Mike Johnson, theocrat. Again, you know, we were outsiders sort of having meetings with senators and congressmen. My dad was not the Speaker of the House.
Right.
Rusus Rushdoony was not the Speaker of the House. Excuse me, everybody. Does anyone out there understand what how radical that is, that, you know, the outsider right-wing Christian leaders who would go and meet with someone and think they were lucky if they met a senator and he listened to them for 10 minutes over coffee? You know, one of ours, so to speak, is now the Speaker of the House. And how do you see, Randall, that transition from outside radical theocratic right-wing reconstructionist Rusus Rushdoony view of the Constitution as somehow unchristian that needs to be modified by biblical absolute, and now he's the Speaker of the House?
Exactly, what the hell? It's frightening to me. It really is frightening to me. And especially because, you know, he, in one of his first interviews, as I'm sure you know, he said, all you need to know about my policy is to take a Bible down from your shelf and read the Bible. And okay, fine. You know, but where are we, where are we turning? He wants to go to Leviticus and, you know, pick out, you know, the clobber passage about homosexuality and use that as a, as a template for public policy. And, you know, again, he claims to be a Christian. I'm not in the business of judging who is and who is not. But if you are a Christian, it seems to me first place to go would be the New Testament. And you can't do better than the Sermon on the Mount or Matthew 25 to get a sense of how public policy might be shaped. But even so, as you point out, and we are not a Christian nation. We have never been a Christian nation.
Right.
The founders were abundantly clear about that. And I also want to argue anytime I can that the First Amendment, I think, is America's best idea, the idea of the separation of church and state. And that is because the founders had seen the ravages of religious warfare in back in England and Europe. They wanted to avoid that. But also because the First Amendment set up a free marketplace for religion in America, where no one religion was preferred or was established. And the consequence of that is a vibrant, salubrious religious marketplace unmatched anywhere in the world. And why various people would want to chip away at this wall of separation between church and state is just... It's unfathomable to me. It's destructive, utterly destructive.
I remember the day when we were out arguing things on the hustings, that one of the points we made was the opposite that Mike Johnson made. To be respectable, you had to say, look, you know, I'm a Christian, but I'm not imposing this on anybody because A, we believe in the separation of church and state, and B, you know, we're loyal to, as patriotic Americans, to our Constitution, our way of government. Thank God we're not living in a theocracy. And that gives us the freedom to be better Christians. Whatever happened to that point of view? That used to be the mainstream. That's what Billy Graham used to say. That's what evangelicals used to say. You know, Billy Graham even repented publicly of the fact he got too close to Richard Nixon. And he says, you'll never do that again. Right. You know, the church and state should not be mixed. I don't know what I was doing there, you know, backing one presidency over another, because this was not my business. I'm an evangelist. You don't hear a whiff of that from anybody anymore. No,
you don't. That's right. That's right. No, it's really unfortunate. And you know, I keep going back to the original metaphor, which came from Roger Williams, who was the founder of the Baptist tradition in America. And he wanted to separate the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world by means of a wall of separation. And what we miss in that metaphor, because we're modern folks, we like to go hiking, we like to go in the wilderness and so forth. Roger Williams was no fan of the wilderness. For him and his contemporaries, wilderness was a place of darkness where evil lurked.
Yeah.
And so when he's separating the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world, what he's saying is that anytime you conflate the two, it is the integrity of the faith that is compromised. And I have a great example of that. I was one of the expert witnesses in the Alabama Ten Commandments case. I'm sure you remember that back from
I do.
2000s. And when the district judge ruled correctly that the monument was a violation of the Establishment Clause and he ordered its removal, one of the protesters screamed, "Get your hands off my God." And unless I missed my guess, one of those commandments on the side of the monument said something about graven images.
Right.
And it's precisely Roger Williams' point.
Yeah.
You compromise the integrity of the faith when you try to merge it into politics or into the state.
In a takeaway from Saving Faith, subtitled How American Christianity Can Reclaim Its Prophetic Voice, let's just take a couple minutes here as we wrap up on the how-to part, and let's hear you on that. Tell us.
Well, I think I probably said it already. I think we have to take seriously that Jesus is the Word of God for people of faith, and we can do far worse than look at His example for how we conduct ourselves in this life and in this world. But we also have to speak from the margins, realizing that this is not going to be a popular ideology, that we call people to account, both the general population and the direction of the country, but also fellow believers. We speak from the margins, and that's where we find our prophetic voice.
Yeah, and it sort of makes me think of something else too, as an extension of what you're saying, and that is that we're in the middle of seeing these Republicans running against Trump without ever calling him out, because they don't dare to. And I would just say, as a warning to someone, speaking as a voice from the margins to my friends who are very much still in the evangelical movement, that, you know, you may not dare to call out what's happening because you're still a pastor or you're still part of a Christian magazine editorial board or whatever. Don't make the mistake that these people are making who are running against Trump, like DeSantis and others, and think that you can run against something without naming it. You have to be willing to step back onto the margins again and take your lumps as a Christian and stop seeking, you know, a shortcut to power and actually regain the prophetic voice. And that has to begin with being willing to let go of paychecks and power and all the perks, the speaking invitations and the rest. And I just think that the evangelical establishment, such as they are, who remain actual evangelicals, you know, have been reticent to call out what they see. And I would just warn them, as someone, not a historian like Randall Balmer, my guest today, but as someone who is an avid reader of history, this never pays off. Right. You know, ask the German Lutheran Church.
Right.
Ask how the papacy was affected by a pope who wouldn't take a stand against the race laws that Mussolini put in place. They're still paying for it. Ask the people who swept under the carpet all the cases of abuse in Ireland. How did that work out for the Irish Roman Catholic Church? So I would just say to evangelicals out there who care about the future of Christ's witness on earth, you know, cut to the chase here. You know, you're going to lose an entire generation. No one is going to buy this. And your silence is deafening. And I think it condemns you, the future. So for the sake of the gospel of Jesus Christ, you know, the prophetic voice may be on the margins, but at least it passes on to another generation something that can live, whereas this silence can't be passed on. And speaking to my evangelical friends, you will pay for this, because it's not going to take long for your credibility to be completely gone. And I don't know how you feel about that, Randall.
Frank, that sounds like an altar call to me.
Yeah, it sort of is. So read Randall's book, Saving Faith, and repent.
That's right. No, I think you're right. History will not be kind to these folks who have turned the other way, or who, especially who have been complicit in this disaster. It's nothing short of a disaster, it seems to me.
Yeah, and I mean, when the churches are empty, just to cut to the chase here, you know, people like Franklin Graham and what he did in selling out to Trump and backing him, and calling out congressmen or senators, even on the Republican side, who didn't completely go with the program. You know, this is what you're going to be remembered for, Franklin. And the same goes for Ralph Reed and all these other people who love being seen in the temple, as it were, and in the places of power and on the stage with Donald Trump at some CPAC meeting. But I promise you, they will all live to regret it, because it's all going to go down. And when those churches are empty and you've lost a generation of young people who have had it with all of you, look in the mirror, because this kind of selling out by evangelical leadership is just stunning to me.
It is. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So where's the book Saving Faith in its publishing history right now? How long has that been out?
I think it's been out, well, I should know, last, maybe August.
Okay, so it's pretty recent.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's new. Yeah, it's,
and then you're working on something now you mentioned, but just remind me what that was.
The biography of Mark Hatfield.
Yeah, who was somebody I met when I was much younger, and who was he, I forget, a congressman or a senator from Oregon?
Senator for 30 years from Oregon.
Yeah, that's right.
Arguably the last liberal Republican in America.
Well, that's an interesting biography to be working on right now in terms of trying to call people back to something who were
exactly
Christian.
He was a conscience. There's no question about that. And he stood firm to his beliefs. He was a really remarkable man.
Okay, so my guest has been Randall Mahmer, who is a professor and an author of Saving Faith. And this is the second time that we've been together on this podcast. And I hope there's more after that. I would
Me
ask
too.
You to please subscribe to In Conversation with Frank Schaefer on Facebook, YouTube, and Apple Podcasts. And is there anything that you would like us beside the book to mention in terms of anywhere you might be or something that coming out, or we'll post links for people who want to talk to you. What else would you like us to be aware of?
Oh, I'm doing a lecture at the College of Charleston next month, and then a lecture at in an Episcopal church in Baltimore on the same trip. And so, yeah, things like that. But mostly I'm trying to stay home and do some writing. So,
well, thank you. And this has just been great. So I appreciate you taking the time in the middle of a busy period of your own life as a writer, and also, you know, all the rest of it. So thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure, Frank. Thank you.
Great talking.
Take care.
In Conversation with Frank Schaefer is a production of the George Bailey Morality and Public Life Fellowship. It is produced by Ernie Gregg and hosted by Frank Schaefer, author of Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, Be Happy, a post-pandemic blueprint for rebalancing work and family in favor of love and living. To learn more and support the show, please visit lovechildrenplanet.com.